Well, I grew up inside the Pentagon. My parents were civilian employees at the Pentagon, as was my aunt who lived with us. And as I grew up, I was often taken by my parents into the Pentagon for the day, for a work day. And as I got older, I always had an interest in reading from when I was very young. And so I would often be dropped off at the Pentagon Library. My father was in charge of the loading docks, and so he took me down into the lower floors of the building. There's actually more floors beneath the ground than there are above. And he showed me where storage areas were. He showed me a very large room where they took paper that they had already used, or that was classified or declassified or whatever, shredded it, pulped it, and made it into notebooks and paper for for the building's use. So they had like a early, this was the 1950s, they had a recycling plant for paper inside the Pentagon.
So in that respect, they were progressive.
Yeah, in that sense. Just that I read later that the National Security Agency, in Bamford's first book, Puzzle Policy, notes that they declassify so much paper every day that in the winter they burn it in order to heat the building. So some part of the paper use gets recycled in these systems. And often the Pentagon is at the cutting edge, as intelligence is, of the technologies, because they're looking for the new technologies so that they can use them for warfare and for advantage. William S. Burroughs has a great quote. He says, if this was the Middle Ages and Magellan was an American and he sailed around the planet and found out it was round instead of flat, that we wouldn't tell anyone so we could attack from the rear. And I think that's the mentality, is that they get out there and try to find the new technologies and then hide them from us. But I'm familiar with the building. I grew up in it and outside of it and around it. And it's changed somewhat over the years, but in terms of how much security, it used to be a much more public and open building and have open public areas and bus routes and everything. And now, over the last, I'd say, 20 years even, from the 80s on, it's become a more secured building. The first security was to keep the homeless out of the public areas who were coming in to sleep. But, that's built up now too. In the mid-90s, I organized a day without the Pentagon and helped organize it, but I was one of the key people. And it was the first Pentagon demonstration there in, 25 years or something. But people had been going to the White House, but nobody going over to the Pentagon. So we marched from the National Cemetery to the Pentagon. And I had to have these meetings because D.C. itself is a multi-jurisdictional district. It's a military district. It's a federal district. It's a local D.C. district. It's a park district. There's separate cops for all these. There's also separate cops for the metro, separate cops for any part of Arlington, separate cops for individual buildings, and separate cops for the Pentagon itself, which is a military reservation. So when you go to negotiate a demonstration from the National Cemetery to the Pentagon, that little stretch of under a mile, you have to talk to 16 different departments in order to negotiate. So there were two of us and about 20 of them. And they told us from the Pentagon security end that this is mid-90s, that they were under a Delta security threat, and therefore we couldn't get up to the actual steps of the Pentagon. And they put a security line between this parade area that they have outside where the Joint Chiefs are and us, so that we couldn't get past it up to the steps of the Pentagon, even though there's been Supreme Court decisions that you can go right up to the steps. They weren't allowing it because of this threat, and they claimed that they had the threat on because they were getting almost daily bomb threat calls from Muslims. And they asked us if Muslims were going to be part of our demonstration. And we said, yes, there are progressive, peaceful Muslims that we work with, in the community here in D.C., and they're going to accompany us. But there's no reason that you should be singling them out. But what I'm telling you is that here's a building on alert 5 years before, to the point that regular people aren't allowed near it, and yet on that day the building is successfully attacked without any defense being put up. I was also told by the main security guy who took me on a little tour actually of the Joint Chief area, where I had never been. My mother had never even taken me in there. She showed me the dining room where they eat and took me through that section, and it was right across from where, you know, we were going to be demonstrating, so there was a question about our sound system disturbing their work that day, and there were other things, but we had a successful demonstration, and actually it was a slow news day. Monica Lewinsky was finally dropping out of the news, and C-SPAN covered the whole thing, all 6 hours, all of our speakers, all of our, and even turned the cameras around and covered the civil disobedience, which consisted mostly of young kids going up and trying to throw themselves across the flower bed and get past the police line and being grabbed and thrown back by the Pentagon security guards. But it was an interesting demonstration. But he took me around and took me outside and said that the demonstration would be filmed and that they had cameras and also radar detectors that were looking at the air over the Pentagon all the time. And so what I'm telling you is that they have an elaborate security system in place and had it in place, you know, from when I was young, because in the 1950s, I used to go with my parents for lunch, during, you know, when they'd have their lunch break, out into the central courtyard and eat lunch. And my parents, I remember my dad showing me surface-to-air missile ports in those areas in the 1950s, you know, that were for the protection of the building. I mean, I didn't understand all they were, but I understood that they were ports where missiles came out of them, you know, could go up in the air. So this is, you know, this is 40, 45 years ago, okay? You just have to figure, I mean, if this is a center of defense for the United States, it must have a way to defend itself, or you'd think it would, especially with the kind of money that we've given it. I also have an image of the Pentagon that really I focused on since, I'd say, the 1970s. I became a draft counselor and GI counselor and veteran counselor during the Vietnam period. I've worked with people that worked for the Pentagon for, you know, many years on the level of the, you know, the grunts and the bats and the people that do the dirty work and assisting them. I had this image, and when I was going around in the 1980s when they began to bring the draft back, I shared this in my draft counselor trainings that I did across the country. And it's that I don't know of any reason symbolically to make a five-sided figure that points south, except that in the arcana of the pentangle is something that you use to summon the devil. And I used to say in my talks that the devil's among us. Well, I'm close enough to the Pentagon physically, I'm in Anacostia right across the river, that I felt the actual blast. It shook the windows of my house. I also was awakened that morning by a call when the first Twin Tower was hit by someone that I know, one of the researchers in D.C. that works on the Kennedy assassination stuff. And he was concerned because he's in air traffic authority in Virginia around Dulles area and sits on some boards that make those decisions. And he called and he said right away that there's something seriously wrong because there's no way a commercial airliner should be anywhere near these buildings, that it's a restricted space, even up in New York, where, of course, just for common safety reasons, you don't bring planes. So he knew something was wrong, and in the course of telling me that he thought something was wrong, the second plane hit. And then he said, my God, the balloon is up, because he and the rest of the country immediately knew that this was not an accident. I mean, coincidence theory goes out the window. This is using planes as weapons. And this is not unknown to the intelligence communities. If you remember, a plane, small plane, Piper plane, but flew into the White House at one point during the Clinton years. And that was a very strange incident. But in response, they built a surface-to-air missile port on the front lawn of the White House and put some bushes around it. And it was mentioned in the Post and at the time, and it's visible there out on the lawn. And so the White House added defense to itself. And this plane on September 11th flew over the White House and over the Capitol, looped around, and then went on this 270-degree turn to hit the one side of the Pentagon that had nobody in it almost. This area they'd been reconstructing for 3 years, and most of the offices were still empty. And it had to go out of its way, literally, I mean, in order to hit that side. I mean, it wasn't that the other sides were blocked access. It was a choice what side they came in on. And it minimized the number of deaths inside the Pentagon and overall to go in on that side. There were more people killed in the plane and the workers outside than were killed inside the Pentagon by the blast. But it was close to home. And then I went downstairs and turned on a combination of local news, Channel 8 and CNN, and whatever national news stuff I could get. And I was flipping around just trying to see what they were reporting. And it was reported on local news and somewhat on national, but very clearly on local news, that a third plane had turned around in Ohio and was heading back toward Washington, D.C. And it was announced that it was coming to D.C. publicly. I mean, this wasn't some kind of state secret. Everyone in D.C. that had a TV or a radio on knew that a plane was coming to D.C. And the authorities certainly knew. It wasn't off their radar screen. And this was about a half an hour before it hit that I heard, you know, on the local news that this plane was headed to D.C. And absolutely nothing was done to interfere with this plane. There were some jets scrambled out of Langley, which is a base 130 miles from D.C., too late to even get to the Pentagon before it was hit. Or at least too late, you know, that I think if the planes flew at the full speed, they could have gotten there, but I don't think they did. You know, because even 130 miles, I mean, these planes go like 550, 600, you know, maybe even 700 miles an hour. So if they're up by 925, can they get there by 948? You know, maybe 130 miles, it doesn't seem. But in fact, they came in 5 minutes after the incident. So it seems to me maybe they weren't even going full speed mm-hmm. once they got off. But there are planes, interceptor planes, right across the river at Anacostia Naval Air Station, at Andrews Air Force Base. These were not put into the sky. And I have seen these planes as a child in D.C., and my relatives have seen them come up and guard that restricted airspace, which is the most restricted airspace in the country, from commercial airliners or private planes that have gone off course and strayed into that space, are intercepted and wagged out of that space. So that's not even in some kind of a crisis or national emergency or plane being used as weapon or what was happening September 11, just in normal course of events. Helicopters, interceptors, things go up in that space because it's guarded. It's guarded space. And they have the capacity, both at the White House and at the Pentagon, to use the surface-to-air missiles, you know. And they also had a formal shoot-down order from Cheney and Bush, according to the press accounts from inside, moments after the second plane hit. Bush and Cheney, you know, spoke and announced that there was a shoot-down order on the remaining planes that were in.
Did that go out over the media?
It didn't go out over the media, but it would have gone out to the military authorities that needed to know it.
Right. So I guess, is there documentation on that?
There is afterward documentation in the media that it happened, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I've got just regular public media reports about it, and they started claiming later that there was no mechanism or they didn't have the right kind of planes at Andrews and yada yada. And I mean, it's all smoke. It's not right. I mean, they have them and they didn't use them. And so regardless of who the sponsor is behind the event, there also was somebody within the chain of command here that made a conscious decision to stand down that day and let that attack happen. And the fact that the attack went out of its way to hit the empty side of the Pentagon tells me that something else is wrong. But D.C. began to go into martial law. They had continuity of government, which means that government's taken away from all but a few members of Congress and put into the hands of people at the top of the National Security Council and the White House. FEMA, Defense Department, and National Security Agency, DIA, and those agencies still are running the country to a great extent more than any democratic process that was in place prior to it. I mean, they already had great influence, but now they openly control us. So, for instance, when the business people started complaining that Reagan National Airport was shut down for too long and they were losing too much money, they had to go and make that complaint to the National Security Agency and the National Security Council and the FEMA and DOD. They didn't, you know, it wasn't a local decision that was going to be made. So D.C. is already federalized. It's a colony, but I mean, it's Now the whole country is federalized in a way that a lot of people don't understand. Because when you declare a formal national emergency, a lot of legal authorities shift over. And decisions are made at other levels. And there are federal regions. And so all sorts of things have shifted in terms of legal niceties and priorities and who's in charge of what once you're in this kind of a declared emergency. It's not yet a declared war. Some more powers were approved, but that's similar to Vietnam. It was not a declared war. Plus, who are we at war with? I mean, you know, we outside of, as I call him, Dr. Osama bin Laden in his magical cave that James Bond can't penetrate, you know, I mean, who is it that we're fighting? And it's sort of enemy of the hour. You know, we'll get the list tomorrow of whether the next four countries we want to go into and bother. So, you know, it's, and all of it's done in secrecy, and we're being told that it has to remain in secret. The evidence is secret. The processes of response are secret. You know, but trust us, we're taking care of you. Well, I mean, we've trusted them to the tune of $13 trillion since the end of World War II. Have they taken care of us? Or have they provided basically what in the old mafia term is a protection racket, where they send a guy around to break your window and they send another guy around to make sure it doesn't happen again for a certain fee. And, you know, the fee is 25% of our hard-earned tax dollars going into this monstrous military machinery and less of it coming back to us. I mean, it's to the point now, I mean, the ludicrousness of it, after all that debate about the Social Security locked box and everything else, now we're being told that the only way they can pay for the tax rebate they gave back, given the deficit that they've created and the military budget that they want and the intelligence budget that they want, is that they're going to have to take it out of Social Security. So our tax rebate is now coming out of our Social Security funds. And you know, similarly, all the priorities now are on defense and intelligence spending and not on social needs. And it's going to be considered irresponsible for Congress people to go the other way. One of the top lobbyists for Boeing said the cookie jar is open, and if any of you vote against defense appropriations, you won't be here next time around. So they have their, you know, their rationale in place for what they wanted to do for a long time anyway. I mean, these things that we're seeing were not created whole cloth after September 11. The so-called Patriot Act that shifted over all these authorities and undermined constitutional rights and other things was like 300 pages, and it was introduced, you know, within days after the attack. So, I mean, they didn't write 300 pages of law in 4 or 5 days. They had it sitting on a shelf waiting for its excuse. And I've actually been following these people in my research, Rand Corporation, and back into the 60s and other big corporations that have been planning this sort of emergency response, emergency preparedness, emergency readiness. And this is really the most hierarchical and most autocratic elements within the government, the most arrogant in terms of, you know, we know what's good for you, and you don't need your rights in order to be, you know, protected. In fact, you better give up your rights if you want to protect your rights. And so it's that kind of logic, but I mean, it comes out of, well, for instance, the Watergate burglars. Many of them were top ranking intelligence guys that could go back to the Bay of Pigs and other covert operations. But McCord, who really pulled the plug on the operation and created the arrest situation and blew the whistle on it, was long-term CIA, but he was also in the Office of Emergency Preparedness in the White House, which was a secret emergency planning operation. He would have been in charge in a declared emergency of all U.S. mail and media. So someone has that position right now who, you know, in this emergency is in charge of the media and what it's allowed to say and in charge of the mail and how it's being processed. And I mean, of course, the anthrax was a good excuse to hold up all the mail, and the mail can be rooted around for cleaning, you know. And, you know, but these are our most basic democratic machinery of mail, communication, internet has now been taken over with Escalon, transportation, you know, around the country, just getting where we need to go, and the broader sort of freedom to communicate, travel, and interchange with each other is compromised in this situation. It was a 16-person committee in the White House those days when McCord was on it. So there are all kind of authorities that change over. Like, ultimately, the Defense Department runs the phone companies and the phone systems in the United States when they kick it in. Defense Department's in charge of all interstate highway systems and can close them off to civilian use. So when I was sitting there in D.C., what I was seeing was a shift over into the continuity of government that's part of emergency planning. Because I've been watching, you know, these plans develop in government studies and things over the years, and the terrorist scenarios, and they have three stages of the scenario, from a conventional bomb attack of some kind to a chemical or biological attack, and then to a nuclear attack. And as they go up each stage in the planning, they get closer and closer to full martial law. And that's the response that they, you know, that they have lined out for this and have studied. And they've built up a tremendous industry, privatized by, you know, Wach and Hud and, you know, these firms, of security for people. I mean, I saw one thing that said that the Pope was traveling when he went on security, was something like 2,000 people were traveling with the Pope just for security. I said, well, if Christ had that much security, we wouldn't have had a religion. But, you know, that's a growth industry. One guy gets 22,000 people to go with him, and then it's almost to the point where if you're going to have 2,000 people hired and the kind of money that takes, they're going to have to create an incident in order to justify their being there after a while, you know. So what I was seeing was a lot of phony terrorism. And they have in Europe what they call strategy of tension, and it's an actual thing that the intelligence community developed within Italy and some of the European countries. And the scam basically boiled down is that the intelligence community goes out to the far right wing and proposes that they do a terrorist action, bomb a train, you know, do something that, and then they will plant evidence that will blame it on the left. So the right wing agrees with it because it's gonna frame the left and also give them, you know, some points, and the government will train them and, you know, make it possible for them to do the terrorist action. The action will happen. It then becomes an excuse for them to crack down on the left. They break the left apart. Then someone internally blows the whistle and says, oh, no, it wasn't the left, it was the right. Then they wipe out the right as well. And then the intelligence agencies, you know, are basically in charge without any opposition. So, but it's called a strategy of tension, and you're basically creating a fear mode so that they can begin to undermine, you know, constitutional freedoms or democratic processes in favor of this intelligence state. And that's really been the tension here, I believe, between the elements of the class that have been warring, and that warfare came to a head on November 22nd, 1963, with the brutal and open assassination of John F. Kennedy, was the final open clash of these elements. But the basic theme of the difference is that there's some elements within those that concentrate the wealth and rule the country, some who want to maintain an illusion of democracy as long as they have the control, but they like to have it seem as if it's a democracy. And, you know, and sort of go along with business as usual with minimum amount of force, and share some of the wealth, just enough to keep people from getting too upset. And then there's those that want to take the glove off the fist and go openly into martial law and open fascism. And that's really the clash. And at certain times, the ones who want to go in the latter direction create the conditions that make it favorable for them to bring that to the fore. If you want a model for what's happening right now in the United States, look at Peru over the last decade, and the rise of Montesinos, and this guy from the intelligence community, who really was the almanos grease behind everything and ran the show, and Fujimori, the president that was elected, Japanese, but I mean president of Peru, and under the guise that they were attacking terrorism of this Shining Path group of Maoists, they dismantled the constitution, took all the powers into the central government, ripped off the treasury, so to speak, you know, and created a police state with secret military tribunals and So, I mean, if you take a really close look at Peru, you'll see a model for what's being proposed now by the Bush administration here in the United States to. And it's not so much that everybody's agenda changed totally on September 11th, or that there wasn't this problem, but what's happened now is that we're being shown finally as the American people that we're not in charge. And to me, that began with the incidents around the election of Bush and the squabble with Gore in Florida, and this last election. Because I've known for a long time that elections are not really what they seem. I mean, they aren't a matter of a democratic process of the majority of American people deciding who's going to be president. I mean, that's, as I say, the illusion of democracy. The reality is that elections and who comes out on top are struggles between segments of this divided class at the top as to who's going to be in ascendancy for a period and whose policies are going to be carried out. And they differ on international issues, they differ on domestic issues to some extent. I mean, not enough to make a great deal of difference for all of us, but to make some difference in terms of what happens day to day. And, I think either way, the system as it's set up is you're in a handbasket on the way to hell. But some people have something that they say is a break that creates a little bit of friction and slows the 150-mile-an-hour handbasket down to 145 miles an hour, maybe. And they pull on it. And then there's other people who just let the brake go and pop out the champagne. So, but they used to balance the tickets. Like if you think of the 60 election, like LBJ and JFK, that's two ends of the money. I mean, those guys aren't, in the same circles. You have an Eastern establishment and a sort of nouveau riche of investment capital in the southern rim in oil and munitions, land speculation that rose up mostly after the end of World War II and this power shift to what became what Eisenhower referred to as a military-industrial complex, that he saw rising out of that. And that money has had a different agenda than the old Eastern establishment, which was Anglophile and had its connections into England and the Europe, and these guys were more nativist and America first and cowboys, as Carl Oglesby refers to them, as opposed to the Yankee investment banker capital. These guys were entrepreneurs, new money. H.L. Hunt is an example. Very, very rich. I mean, richer than the Rockefellers, but not anywhere near as savvy as to how to make that money do, what Rockefellers did with it in terms of social control. So Hunt used to say, "When I go east, they treat me like a stable hand." There's differences, but they used to balance the ticket somewhat. Now I think they don't. I mean, I think Clinton and Gore basically represent the same side in the way that Cheney and Bush do. So they're really more fighting entirely within their own camps now rather than internally trying to balance the situation. But in that sense, elections then are only shifts in terms of which part of the class is going to rise. So I remember on the local news in D.C. the day of Clinton's inauguration, the disgruntled Poppy Bush leaving town, getting on the airplane and saying into the camera angrily, "Well, I'll give him his term, but then I'm coming back." So as soon as I heard that Shrub, the son, was going to run, I knew that he was going to win, that this was the ascendancy, this was the coming back. And they had already done the current version of assassination as scandal. So they had already scandalized Clinton into a corner. I remember a demonstration that I was at in front of the White House when they started bombing Kosovo again. Clinton ordered new bombing runs in Kosovo, and we went out to protest that. And there was, strangely enough, that night more press there than there were demonstrators. So press were pushing us aside and sticking microphones in everybody's mouth and letting us talk, and the park police were trying to move us across the street with their horses, and the Catholic worker people knelt down in front of the White House to get arrested. But right then, within the perimeter zone, because they have now all these barricades, there's no traffic across the front of the White House except foot traffic. But within that zone, they have some cars that they let in. And one of those cars, for who knows whatever reason, it was just sitting there, but the engine caught fire and the carburetor was like shooting this huge fire thing into the sky, you know, like a column of fire. So all the Secret Service guys ran out and the police ran over. So for at least a half an hour, they had to deal with that in the fire department. And meanwhile, the Catholic workers are there praying and waiting to get arrested. And we're marching around with nobody bothering us because they haven't gotten their stuff together. So maybe it was in response to that. All I know is there was a tremendous amount of press. So, and they had their Klieg lights on, and when the cops came to take our bullhorn away, we all started chanting First Amendment, and, you know, the press caught that, and the cops backed off, and finally they brought the horse police out and chased us across the street. But what was interesting to me is a guy from UPI came up to me, and he said, do you think this is a case of tail wags the dog? In other words, did I think that Clinton was bombing Kosovo in order to get past the scandal of Monica Lewinsky? Mm-hmm. Because he was right on the edge of being, you know, the vote on impeachment.
Right.
And I said, no, I think this is the head wagging the tail. I said, I think this is a situation where the Pentagon and the people that are really in charge of the country and the military-industrial complex are ready to go to war. They have Clinton over a barrel with this scandal, and they're basically telling him, if you don't cooperate with us, we're going to impeach you over this scandal. And so he's going to do the bombing, and then they're going to drop the impeachment. And this was quite shocking to this UPI guy. And he said, well, but he's the president. He's the commander-in-chief. And I said, look, the commander-in-chief's come and go. The Pentagon sits there. I said, I'm sure when he gets in, they tell him you're the president, but that's all you are. And, mm-hmm. you know, they can show him a picture of the Zapruder film if he doesn't get it, you know, of Kennedy being shot in 63. So, you know, I knew that it was a matter of them putting somebody up, and there's a script that I've watched from when I was very young about how elections go in this country. And it got more and more sophisticated, of course, than it was in the 50s, but basically they give you two candidates that they pre-select. They don't allow any third-party candidates to really have any impact or access. They frame the debate and tell you what the issues are that you should be concerned about, whether they're your issues or not. And then they have the two candidates debate and posture as if they're completely different on these issues. And then, before they have an election, they have polls. Well, now, why would you have a poll in a democratic society before you had an election? The only purpose is to influence the outcome of the election. I mean, what other purpose could you have in knowing who was going to win ahead of time? Except to try to, through the poll, influence how people would vote. And in fact, I hear people say, well, I'm not going to waste my vote on a loser. And so it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, and people vote for who they think is going to win, or they'll withhold their vote. So I remember before the election, knowing that Bush was coming in and going to the top, I had these people that were interested and supportive of Nader at one of my talks. And I myself don't vote. I consider it what I call the evil of two lessers. I don't vote because there isn't anything to vote for me in a representative. I want to vote directly on issues that affect my life. That's democracy to me. It's not electing somebody who claims to represent tens of millions of people or hundreds of millions of people in one person and then doesn't even go about talking to those people to find out how they want to be represented. You know, that's not representative democracy. It's not anything. It's neither representative nor is it democracy. So I don't play that game. It's a rigged game anyway, but for those as do, they wanted to vote Nader and they wanted to have this third party. But they were nervous that if they voted for Nader, it would mean that Bush would win. And I said, look, Bush is going to win anyway. So at this point, a vote for Gore is a vote for Bush. And if you want to vote for Nader, you should vote for Nader. Maybe he'll get the 5%. He could have, for all I know. They probably wouldn't admit it. You know. But they wanted to get 5% so they could get the party money and run next time and get the issues out. And, you know, it's good for educational for that. But ultimately, I agree with Washington and Jefferson and the early founders of the country that parties, political parties, are inimical to democracy. Both of them believed that and knew that that was the case. Jefferson said that in any society, you can only have two parties no matter what they call themselves. those who want to take the power from the people and put it in the hands of an elite, who we call the aristocrats, and those who want to take it from the elite and put it in the hands of the people, who we call the Democrats. And he said, in a democratic society, you don't need a democratic party. And Washington, when he was leaving office, said that policy decisions belong in the hands of the people themselves. And he said to have a political party means that you're taking that decision out of the hands of the bulk of the people and putting it in the hands of a few. And so I think they're correct in that, and I think that parties have essentially wrecked the democratic process. And we've had the technology of mass communication since the 1930s to have direct participatory democracy, full debate on issues, informed populace and everything else, but instead commercial interests have taken over the media that's our commonwealth and fed us disinformation and, you know, played these control games with us instead of letting us decide about our lives. And that's really, I think, you know, what has to happen if we're going to make any change. But in the script, then what happens is that they take a poll, they tell you who's ahead in the horse race, they play with you for a few months, they come to the actual election night, and then they still don't wait for the election. They announce from exit polls who has won the election before it actually ends. And then one of the candidates gets up and concedes. Now this is the script. And then you have the president. They don't second count. They don't look at absentee ballots. They don't worry whether the last guy in the military over in Guam got his vote in. It's decided by concession and by a script. And the only thing that shocked me was that Gore that night didn't go along with the script, because they went to Bush first. And they said on the news that Gore had taken Florida based on their exit polls. The Bush family was out to dinner. Word got out. They ran home. Jeb got on the phone to his friends in Florida. I mean, you can just imagine that, those conversations. And the press got up into the mansion, into the little room where they could have like a press conference. And Bush came down. And they said to Bush, well, what's your response? They've announced that Gore has taken Florida, which means he's going to get the Electoral College win. Bush said, very calmly, it ain't going to come out that way. Well, he knew how it was going to come out. You see, he didn't say, well, let's wait till all the votes are counted. He knew that. He said, it ain't going to come out that way. And that, to me, was the quote of the year. I mean, you know, and it ain't going to. It's going to come out how they predetermined it's going to come out. But the thing that was strange to me was that they would show it to us.
Right.
Because Gore is as much of a player within the class system as Bush is. And they're not that, the rivalry isn't that sharp that they're going to start messing with their own game. So eventually it came to me that they want us to know. Because when Gore balked, it pulled up a petticoat, and it ain't pretty underneath. And the United States showed not only us, but the whole world, that we are not a democracy, that we don't elect by the numbers. And as I've often said, they can't afford to let an election come down to the vote. You think they're going to make this whole system on their behalf and concentrate this amount of wealth and then throw it back to us and say, what do you want to do with it? They're not going to leave it up to us. We know that they'll spend $10 million to rig an election in Chile. What do you think, they'll only do it in Chile? What do you think they spend here where it counts, where it really matters? Okay, so the elections aren't up to us, but now suddenly they pull up this petticoat, and what do we find out? We find out that people are illegally disenfranchised from voting. We find out that people are blocked from getting to the polls. We find out that the machinery of the voting is rigged in certain ways that makes the vote unclear. We find out that the counting processes, you know, aren't legit. You know, layer after layer after layer, we see that the whole machinery of the election itself is already, you know, flawed. And then on top of that, that there's all these, you know, shades and things that the Supreme Court got into about, you know, and just in case, I mean, you know, everything goes wrong and the populace should actually put in a candidate that none of the rulers want, then they have the Electoral College as the final control, you know. So all of that, though, was basically shoved in our face. And in a very brutal way, that basically said, you know, we done told you who the president is, now sit down and shut up.
Why would they do that? Was that just to totally, finally demoralize whatever resistance there might be?
I think it was to send the signal in a clear way to us that we are not in charge, and they don't even care that now that we have an illusion that we're in charge, because they're going to go to a situation where they're not going to rely on us for, you know, for even that sort of illusion. And it's just basically, you better go along. I mean, they were telling us that in 63 when they took Kennedy from us. They were saying, you know, we're taking him. He's not going to be the president. We don't care if you elected him. And we can kill him. We can sure as hell kill you and just get out of our way. But now they're saying, like, you know, you don't even count. You know, I mean, just forget it. We're not even playing with you. The glove is coming off the fist, and this is what I had been saying for like 5 or 6 years. I did a talk about 96 in Los Angeles called Are You Scared Yet? And it was about terrorism and counterterrorism, phony terrorism as I called it, because there were constant incidents under this strategy of tension of terrorism where the group never was heard of before, it was never heard of again, it took credit for it. Often it came out that the group had been connected with or trained by or armed by the CIA, then the CIA would say, oh, we never knew they'd do anything like this. Then the incident would disappear, and then there'd be another one in a new group, and it had a CIA tie. And so I got to the point where I said, well, it's a good thing there's no real terrorists, because these incidents were staged one after another. And that came up the day the plane went into the White House. Because I got up in the morning, and they said, a plane has flown into the White House, unknown origin of the plane, unknown pilot, pilot's dead. You know, but you don't have to worry because President Clinton isn't in the White House. They were doing renovations, and he's over at the Blair House. Well, not only is the Blair House the place where Truman was attacked by the Puerto Ricans in an earlier incident, but, I mean, here it is. I mean, if you really had terrorists, you don't know who this guy is. You don't know if he has accomplices, and you're going to announce, hey, you missed him. He's over at the Blair House. That's what I say. It's a good thing there's no real terrorists. Then later on, they were trying to explain the incident, and how did this plane come into the White House and nobody saw it? And they said, oh, well, he flew down from Baltimore. He took a plane. They said that this is a guy that was living, he'd been disappeared for a couple of weeks. He had been living on 100% disability at a VA psychiatric facility. His son said that, you know, afterwards, his son said, oh, my dad has keys to lots of planes. A guy that lives on 100% psychiatric disability at the VA has keys to lots of planes? What does that mean? And then he goes down and he takes a plane that's not his and he flies out of this little airport in Baltimore down to D.C. Well, what, the plane goes up and the guy in the tower there at the little airport says, there goes another one, Harry, who he thinks in it? There's no alert. You know, the stolen plane, he comes down, and then they said, well, he was flying below tree level across the mall so we couldn't see him on the radar. Because they first said they didn't see him on the radar, and they said they couldn't see him on the radar. Well, that was right when they were trying to get, I think the guy's name was Duval, out of Haiti, but had taken over in Haiti from Aristide, and they wanted to put, in those days, they wanted to put Aristide in. Now they don't like him. But I said, oh, well, there's the perfect plan. I said, you get 100 vets off the psych wards in the VA, you give them Piper Cubs, and they fly into Haiti below tree level, and nobody can see them, and they attack the palace. It's the perfect plan. I mean, of course you can see a plane below tree level. I mean, maybe a mountain would get in the way, but I mean, a plane has got to come down into the tree level first. He didn't fly below tree level all the way from Baltimore. But I mean, radar wouldn't be any use if you couldn't see, you know, at least something's coming at you with other objects in the way. You can still see something moving. So I mean, that was an absurd story. Then they said they didn't see him. Then they said, oh, they'd gone over the tapes and he was, in fact, on the radar. Now, this is the same radar, I mean, you know, that obviously was operating on September 11th, you know. And then finally, their final story was that they did, he was on the radar tapes, they did, the plane was picked up all the way through, but it was between 3 and 4 in the morning, and they don't look at the radar screen those hours. I said, again, it's a good thing there's no real terrorists, because you've just told them you don't look at anything between 3 and 4 in the morning. You know, their duties, if you're going to believe this nonsense,
right?
You know. I mean, obviously to me, they let the plane come in, and they let it hit the White House as a message to Clinton, you know. And then the kicker for me was that midway through the day, they said the Clintons knew about the incident, but they weren't going to change their plans, and they were going to go out that evening as planned to the Ford Theater. where Lincoln had been assassinated, to the Ford Theater. So who picked that day on the calendar? You know, the day they stayed at the Blair House and went to the Ford Theater, the plane goes into the front. So, you know, it's a situation where I knew that they had been doing these kinds of things and setting up these terrorists. And the same with McVeigh in Oklahoma City. I mean, there's a whole strange background on him. And they claim he was kicked out of Special Forces on the basis of a psychological test that they gave him when he got down there. Well, they give you the psych evaluation before they recommend you. They don't take you and recommend you and then give it to you down there. He was the soldier's soldier. He was like cream of his unit. He had a reputation for shooting the white flag, surrender flags that came up in the Gulf War. It was a door gunner on a helicopter, and if you saw somebody trying to surrender, he would shoot at them. You know, and he was the perfect soldier, and they brought him down into the Special Forces, and then they claimed that he got out of the Special Forces because he took a 4-mile run the first day with a pack on, and he couldn't make it, and he wrote a letter saying, I can't do it. And then they just, okay, Tim, you know, you're kicked out. Well, I mean, have you ever been in the military? I mean, the military will say, like, what do you mean you can't do it? And you're going to do it, you know, and they're going to kick you until you do it, you know. And so, I mean, this idea, you write a little letter, I can't do it, you know, and run 4 miles, I mean, you know, what's that to the... So the whole thing just seemed phony to me, and I think that instead he went down there and was taken into a deep cover, you know, intelligence unit that he was trained in very, very special forces. And then he was given a discharge that's even phonier than Oswald's discharge. Oswald got a discharge supposedly because 9 months before, a box had fallen on his mother's nose, and that she had swelling of her nose. That was the term, you know, that they used in the medical documentation. Her nose swelled up when the box fell on it, and therefore he got discharged from the Marines. I said, don't try it. They'll probably make your nose swell, you know. Hey, can I get out? A box fell on my mom's nose 9 months ago.
Well, it's still mom.
Yeah. And she needed him to come home. It was a hardship case, you know. That's how Oswald got out of the Marines. And so in the same way, you know, McVeigh gets out. There's a letter that says, my military duties are interfering with my civilian employment. Excuse me? I mean, first of all, you're not even legally supposed to have civilian employment while you're in the military. It's considered moonlighting, and you can be court-martialed for it. But secondly, the last thing they're going to do, I mean, the military's view is not going to be that. It's going to be that your civilian employment is interfering with your military duties, right? And you're going to have to stop the civilian employment. But instead, they gave him a discharge, supposedly, based on this. And I call him the schmuck in the truck, because he's supposed to have made this huge fertilizer bomb to go bomb this federal building in months of planning and blah, blah, blah. Okay. There's two separate eyewitness accounts, one at a gas station and one at a street corner, within the 45 minutes before the bomb goes off, of McVeigh and a second guy in the truck stopping and asking directions of how to get to the federal building. Well, don't you think, I mean, if you're going to go so far as to make this huge bomb, you're going to know where you're going? Is you're going to do a dry run at least? And so he goes and he parks the truck in front of the building, and his automobile is there. So I think he's just, like I say, the schmuck in the truck. Take this truck, drive it to this building, your car is there. That's all. And maybe the bomb was in the truck, maybe it wasn't, because the only photo I've ever seen of the truck was at the other end of the building than where the crater was. But even if it was in the truck, I don't think McVeigh knew what he was doing. I think that he, you know, he went there, he was told to pick up his car, he didn't know exactly where he was going, he, you know, went the route, and the car didn't have any license plates on it. He didn't notice, so the first state trooper that sees him on the highway pulls him over. And I read that guy's report. And McVeigh, he asks McVeigh if he's armed, and McVeigh gives up his gun. Well, I mean, if you've just killed hundreds of people in a building, what's one more cop? You know? Why are you the little lamb? You know, I mean, this is a trained killer. I mean, what's making him so shy? You know, and you'd think he's a desperate guy, like trying to get away from the, you know, he's not going to want to be arrested. He goes quietly, but the report says that when he pulls McVeigh over, a blue van that was behind McVeigh pulls over in front of him. and he sits there all through the arrest. And then by the time he gets McVeigh secured, he goes up to the blue van and he says, you know, I wasn't pulling you over. You can go. But he notes in the report that in the front seat of the van, there's two license plates. That's the control, you see. Who's watching him until he's arrested? So he's the patsy in that sense. I mean, why he later takes the blame, what assurances they give him, because you think he'd at least be upset about the fact that he's going to be killed, if he was killed. And I have actually a question about that, because people were talking about, you know, the witnesses were complaining that they thought they saw him breathing after the time that he was declared officially dead, and how long it took him to close his eyes, and, I mean, they may have killed him, but they may also have promised him they weren't going to kill him. And if you do it by injection, how do you know what he's being injected with? You know, when you see somebody frying an electric chair, you pretty well know they're dead, but, you know. So, I mean, he could have just been injected with something to put him out, you know.
Right.
And, you know, I never saw any reports of an autopsy. There was some later thing that said his ashes were taken to some secret place on his instructions. So, who knows about Tim McVeigh? But I don't think we've got the full story on that one either. And there was evidence of bombs inside the building. So I think these terrorist incidents, in the same way that they are in Europe, are planned in conjunction with at least a segment of this internal security state, military industrial, you know, military intelligence, and DIA, I think, have a lot to do with it. And then they get the benefits of the fear and the social consequences that come out of them. And they may be things that are coming independently anyway that they find out about and they don't interfere with. Because they knew, for instance, in the first Twin Tower bombing, an FBI unit came across these guys making the plans, and they had an inside informant that was telling them about where they were mixing the bomb and setting it all up, and the FBI told them not to interfere and to let the thing happen, basically. And there are elements that interfere with real investigations when they do come across these things. Like there's an FBI agent, O'Neill, who quit the FBI over the study of the Taliban and the Al-Qaeda. And he said that basically the CIA and the administration were blocking the FBI inquiry into the terrorist cells there on behalf of the oil companies, who didn't want them messing with them because they had their arrangements. And so it can be that they find something that's going and they let it go, or they help it along. Like there's instances in COINTELPRO where the FBI, they come and the group, you know, the group's not doing anything illegal. They have the provocateur tell them to do something illegal. The group says, we don't have any skill in that area. We don't know how to break into a building. The guy says, oh, I've got lockpicks. I've got bombs. I've got, you know, they provide everything, you know, and entrap the people into a plan, you know, that then they can arrest them for. So maybe they help them along, or maybe they just stand out of the way. But at least in D.C., when we had 40 minutes to respond, at least, to sit there and not put up any kind of a defense and not use the local defenses that the buildings themselves have against this plane that everyone knew was a weapon at that point, there's no rational explanation for that, in my view, except it was a military stand-down, in the same way that on November 22nd, Maximilian Reich at Sam Houston was going to bring military units in from military intelligence there as backup to the Secret Service visit in Dallas, was told to stand down. He was ordered to stand down and not bring the units in. Police units that normally would have guarded and overseen Martin Luther King were called off prior to the assassination. I talked to Strategic Air Command bomber pilots who were in the air the hour of the Kennedy assassination, got news of the assassination, figured that there would be a national response to some kind of an emergency, maybe even a nuclear war. Went to get their code books in the plane, that they're decoding books that give them the messages from the president, from command and control centers, secured locations, that can go all the way up to failsafe, which means you go beyond a point you can't return and you deliver the bombs. There weren't any code books aboard. And when they landed and talked to the other pilots on that shift, they didn't have code books on their planes, November 22nd, 63. That's the defense of the United States compromised. There's very few people who could have had their hands in it besides the Joint Chiefs. There isn't a mafia goon or a CIA schlepper or an Anacaster Cuban that could do anything to the SAC bomber pilots and their code books. They told me it was 16 hands on and off for the new when they shifted them. It's a whole process, and it was set up by General Curtis LeMay. No friend of the Kennedys. Furious with them from going back to, you know, the Bay of Pigs stuff, you know, and the guy that ran with George Wallace later and said that they had to bomb Vietnam back to the Stone Age, and the guy that's portrayed as General Jack Ripper in Dr. Strangelove, you know, and Kubrick's film. You know, and basically a right-wing maniac up there, you know, totally anti-communist, wanting to go into World War III, you know, with the Soviet Union at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Only Kennedy stood against these plans, we now know from the release of the new documents. And he's also a guy that was seen at the autopsy. I talked to Paul O'Connor, a Navy guy that was working on Kennedy's head. And Commander Hume, the Navy commander, told him to... It was a teaching morgue in the Bethesda Naval Hospital, so there were bleachers. And there were upwards of 60 people watching the autopsy, which I never knew. I thought it was, you know, closed room. And at one point, Commander Hume noticed someone smoking a cigar. He said his arms were crossed, he was grinning, he was smoking a big cigar. And Hume said to Paul O'Connor, "You tell that SOB with the stogie to get the hell out of here." And O'Connor ran toward the bleachers, got close enough to see who it was, and turned on his heel. It was General Curtis LeMay. And he created SAC. He created Strategic Air Command. So he would have known how to, you know, how to compromise it. But my thought is that the planners knew that Oswald would be planted as the patsy. Oswald, who had been painted and dipped as a red. Pro-Castro, defector to the Soviet Union, and that they had planned that day to blame it on Castro. I got later evidence that they had troops ready to go in and invade Cuba. I talked to a Navy SEAL who was in a unit that was supposed to go in and actually kill Castro on November 22nd. But when Oswald survived in this Texas theater and the cops failed to kill him with the pistol that I believe they brought in, then they had a talking head and not a dead red. And they had to call the plan off. But they didn't want, on the other hand, somebody outside of the need-to-know loop to freak out and say, "My God, the Soviets killed them," and go to nuclear war. So they made it impossible that day to go to nuclear war by disarming the SAC bomb.